I'm going to read a section from sort of the middle of this book. It's a dream scene. I haven't read it in a long time. And this book, for those of you that haven't already heard me read from it, is it's about two friends going around the South together, one of whom is a singer sales agent, and the other of whom is the narrator and his friend. And it's about their experience together as the singer sewing company collapses. And as they pass through a number of sort of fires and horrible situations together. So this is kind of a gentler moment. It's a dream that the narrator is having. I nodded off briefly. I see I was rambling before I laid the pen aside, and then I found myself sleeping. I had a dream, one I have fairly often these days, in which I recall vividly, the second night of our tour together, Charles and I, when we returned to the Piney Lodge from our evening with Jane. The dream is always a little different, but each time I visit it, not as something I'm beginning anew, but rather a thing the details of which I'm endeavoring to remember, as though on each occasion approaching the same half-familiar and twilight city from a different direction. Can you hear that? It is a faint light that I follow, yet I've been here many times before, and always illuminated by this late light, late in the summer, late in the day, when the sun kneels beneath the horizon, a cumulative light thrown from ground floor windows over the deepening lawns of urban yards, yellow rectangles upon porch rails and flower beds, hedges of black soaked green, deep trunks of trees, and a child's red bicycle overturned and glossy as candy. All these lights together, the lights of a city raised at once, make a larger light, a music in the air above a town slipping into night. There are people sitting upon the damp lawns beneath the trees as if in caverns of leaves that stretch in monotone chambers down the street. In a neighboring yard, another group is camped, sprawled on the grass. A woman in a white cardigan whistles and inscribes some instruction in the air toward a girl silhouetted in the doorway of a house, and the girl glances back, her dress soft as a moth, before she turns and goes inside. In the grass, a boy thinks what it means to go inside, but his words are so new, they separate from their objects and cure in the air. He looks slyly up at his mother, at these women, like a spy. The women sit in a loose ring above the boy, a few steps from the sidewalk where girls in spring dresses run. He watches the girls dart and swim in the dusk into the street this evening, devoid of traffic, and in between lanes up across the broad median on which yet more people sit or lie, freckling beneath the emerging stars. There are hundreds of people reclined or running in childish games or ambling down the block toward a light that grows and gently throws itself upon all of them. His eye lingers, then withdraws with a catch as something dawns on him. Where are all the boys? Where are the men even? His own father. He stands, a shaky tower, and his mother clasps his hips. She points down the street. You were asleep. Daddy took your brother to see the fire. Do you want to go look at the fire? She asks. She asks the quick turn of his head. He nods and regards the crowd. Do you see Daddy, his mother says? Milton? He turns and smiles at her, and she smiles back. Gently, she releases his legs, and he begins his journey across uneven terrain. He's jealous that his brother should be together with his father without him. He's often suspected that they prefer each other's company. His mother's words settle upon him, distracting. And perhaps this is why his eye wanders from the waving figure in the blur of children and arrives instead upon the fixed star of a girl in the street, rolling a hula hoop around her waist. She's wearing yellow, the hoop glowing like a halo in the evening. Other girls move in flocks of light on all sides, but they pay her no attention, and she pays them the same mind, staring down at the ring in which she's contained. He rambles on, nearer to the median now, watching the girl with a hoop, until he grasps the slope in his hands and it fills his vision. When he stands, the children, all these girls with their jump ropes, their marbles, and their dresses, each a tiny house with porches and gardens, stare up at him from the street like frogs. Looking back, he sees his mother, and he waves. She waves, then turns to her friends. Below, the girl with the hula hoop sways in the dusk. She might be 10. She's separated by her magic circle from everything in the world. His attention falters, and he looks back toward his mother, but she's still speaking to someone. If she would just turn, he thinks, and then he looks around. The girl has moved. Not very far, yet it makes him anxious. She stands at a corner where a little street emerges like a creek from between the houses and joins the avenue. He feels himself a bark drawn in the current of a secret entrance to the sea, and he makes his way toward the glowing ring descending the bank. Down amongst the young again, the world is a tumult. The girls have long brown hair. Their games have girl rules, which relate to animals, as if girls are themselves more like animals. The girl with a hoop drifts as she twirls and slips down the little street between the homes and darkened lawns. He follows. She isn't far, turning slowly without looking up or around. One of his shoes has untied itself, and he bends down to grasp the loose lace. Only in rising from where he concentrates does he realize that he's wandered some distance from the picnic activities on the boulevard. At the next intersection, where a lamp makes a small, dirty pool, she's stopped and still turning, still oblivious to him. He draws nearer, and with each step she seems to grow brighter. Perhaps now, he thinks, he'll finally catch her, though what, he wonders, would he do? And in so thinking, without warning, she comes loose from her pivot, rounds the corner, and disappears behind a hedge. It is as if a needle has lifted from a record. Trembling a little, he hears the sound of leaves shushing in the trees, and once more glances about. There is a prickly quiet to the air. The voices of the picnickers failing amongst the rasp of leaves, the ticking and rustling of watered grass. A cricket speaks to him from the fringe of a lawn. Behind, the excitement of the avenue has dwindled to almost nothing, and the yards on either side of where he stands appear deserted, the boles of the trees emerging like pillars in the inner structure of the night. Thinking again of the girl, he walks a little farther towards where she's vanished. Even when he hears a brisk crack and notices a movement where a shape detaches itself from a tree, the shadow of a large man waiting quite still, he walks on. There's something familiar to the boy in the shape and stance of the man. He has less the feeling of walking into him than of catching up after an absence. "Are you looking for something?" the man asks, his face a block of darkness beneath the brim of a hat. And then after a moment when there is no reply, "You're lost, aren't you?" The boy hesitates, regarding the hand the stranger holds down to him. "It's all right," the man says, "if you don't take my hand." His voice isn't unkind. There's an odor of alcohol. "I'm going to look at the fire. Do you want to look at the fire?" And so they set off, the man keeping gait at the boy's side. "Is your father with the company?" the man inquires after a time. "Aren't you with the company?" the boy replies, in a manner of speaking. Nearer the avenue, the man comes more into view. He has a strong, bearded face. He's dressed in a dark suit that's been rumpled from sitting in damp grass. He looks, the boy thinks, like a president from another century, or a grandfather. The wrinkles around his eyes are soft and oiled. "You look like someone," the boy says. "That may be. I have a daughter you might know. Her name is Elizabeth." "Elizabeth isn't a name, it's a place," the boy replies. This is in Elizabeth, New Jersey. To which the man smiles but acknowledges, "I suppose you're right." As they come to the corner and the noise of the street percolates around them, he doffs his hat to a passing young woman. She stares at him briefly before her eyes snap away to other sights. They stroll side by side into the file of stragglers, moving towards a brightness ahead where sparks shimmer in the sky. "I'd be You're willing to wager, he said, taking the boy's hand at last, that not far from where we stand, someone, likely your mother, is worried about you. The man indicates an opening in a knot of people, between whose shoulders the glow condenses and intensifies. Thank you for holding my hand, the stranger confides as they draw into the crowd. You're going to laugh, and it's much better here, yet I've always been afraid of the dark. The boy looks up and smiles. He says, I don't believe you, unsure if he's being teased. The man glances down in surprise. You should never tell anyone, he shakes his head, that you don't believe them. But he too is smiling. Grasping the boy beneath his arms, he hoists him onto his shoulders, and it is then that the boy sees the fire. In a clearing normally employed as a baseball field, a small two-story home has appeared this night. It is like so many others around it, except that it is full of flames. At first he is uncertain what to think, but the man, carrying him and good-naturedly navigating the clots of people, threads his way near enough that they feel the heat on their faces and see the details of the fire, licking the transoms of windows, twining the pillars of the porch, moving about upstairs through the rooms like a person looking for something. A great cheer erupts on either side, coaxing the boy from his bewilderment until he allows himself, voluptuously, to fall into the pleasure of the fire. All around he sees the men and boys he'd looked for in vain only a few minutes before. They're clapping and shouting. It even seems to him they're clapping more for the fire, so large and clear it might be made of colored strips of cellophane, than the firemen in their yellow and black suits, slick with water as they grapple with a fantastical device of a fire truck. An idea occurs to him. Whose house is that? Belongs to the fireman, the man says. But who lives in that house, he asks. No one, the man tells him. It's nobody's home. They built it for the fire, so they could put it out. Both of them return their attention to the blaze, although the boy is thinking now about what the man said. The firemen push against the flames, advancing. They signal to one another, as if they pursued the fire into a corner. A ladder reaches a window, vanishing into steam and smoke, where a fireman clutching a shiny hose braces against an invisible pressure. Under cover of renewed cheers, one of the men is beating the front door with an axe. In a flurry, they are running, signaling, hoses trained through the windows, and then the door is down. Men rush in, coats enormous and dark against the furnace of the interior. But it is at last time to admit that there is a fear that always comes over me here. I might forget the fear until this very moment, but then I remember, and it begins. I haven't been afraid to see the boy come upon the stranger on an empty street, and I haven't been afraid of the fire itself, although, as I've explained before, like the stranger, I am afraid of the dark. What fills me with fear on each occasion are the boy's eyes as they rove the cheering crowd. The people around him make a hush and rushing sound. A man in a felt hat puts both hands to his mouth and whistles, filling the air with a soft cloud of spit. A burly woman hoists her son on two stout arms and shouts through the back of the child's head. The child is raising his hands and clapping, hair in a flurry, and the boy too is clapping. For an instant, an older boy catches his eye, but then the youth, perhaps 15, acne-scarred and whiskered like a catfish, wipes his brow and returns his broad face to the scene. And I am afraid. Afraid, watching the boy searching among these people for a familiar face, that he will realize he knows all of them. I am afraid that he will see that these are a lifetime of faces, of people he hasn't met yet, but whom he will come to know, and who will come to know him. I'm afraid that they've been gathered here from his entire life because they know him, that there are people here who have called him by pet names, people he's borrowed money from, people he's made love with, whom he has watched die, and perhaps even people who have watched him die. They surround him, and I can only hope that as long as he remains clapping, unaware, they will not notice him. I tremble to think that his eyes might meet any of their eyes, because I am sure then that he will know why he is there, and they will know why they are there too. And I imagine the things they might say when they see who he is, the terrifying things they might tell him about the life he hasn't had yet, but which they remember, and in which one day he will be swept away. He bends down toward the stranger's ear as if he were murmuring to a horse. "Who are you?" he asks to no answer. And again, "Who are you?" The man glances at him. "Me," he replies, "I'm nobody, just nobody at all," turning back to the fire. There is then a sound, at first like a fire alarm, of more trucks arriving, until it grows both too large and too small, and I think that this must be it, the end I've been dreading, materializing as any apocalypse, in undreamt of form, at the hand of a vassal, in the shape of a fly or germ. And then it becomes another sound that surrounds us, arriving at last as the sound of the world, the other world. I'd sat bolt upright in near darkness. There was a sharp chirping noise coming from somewhere in the room. The room, I realized after a long moment, at the Piney Lodge. I'd left the bathroom light on, and staring about, I found I'd fallen asleep on the edge of the bed, fully dressed, much as I did just a moment ago here at the Idol. Throwing on the bedside lamp, I also discovered Charles, startled by the flood of light, busy with the tiny buttons of his digital watch. "I'm sorry," he said after a moment. "I don't know what's wrong with this thing. Were you having bad dreams?" "A nightmare," I murmured, as he succeeded in turning off the alarm. Discovering myself still slightly drunk and luxuriating in the knowledge that it was, after all, only a dream, I lay back, kicking off my shoes. "And then I'm afraid of the dark," I added, feeling brave enough to again switch off the lamp. Caught for those few seconds of brilliance, the room lay burned in my brain. I expected to fall immediately back to sleep, but instead remained awake, alternately revisiting the shrunken fears of my dream and regarding the ceiling through a screen of sound as I sank into the crinkled plastic heart of the mattress. The electric purr of the hotel sign, trucks moaning out on the highway. It had finally occurred to me that perhaps this was the time to tell Charles of the terrible turn in my life. Here in this confessional darkness, feeling still the warmth we had shared in the bar, I just said his name out loud, in fact, when I realized by certain unmistakable sounds that my friend was asleep. Thank you.